This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You know, I've really been looking forward to the talk this evening because I expect it's going to help us look at something that's very important in a whole different way. That something is the Internet, which is the subject of Virginia Heffernan's new book, Magic and Loss. Now, that title isn't exactly one you'd expect for a book about the Internet. And in a minute, I'm sure Virginia will explain the title's significance, as she does in the book's preface. But basically, you can get a glimpse of where she's going from the book's subtitle, The Internet as Art, which is to say she approaches the Internet not simply as a new technology or as a business tool, as many other writers have, but as a cultural phenomenon, arguing that because the Internet has so disrupted life as we knew it, we need a new aesthetic to understand its effect on society and on us. So Virginia examines the Internet as a cultural critic would, which she happens to be. She wrote TV criticism for Slate before joining the New York Times in 2003, first as a TV critic and then as an Internet columnist for the Sunday Magazine. Her own exposure to the digital world dates back decades to her preteen years when she found her way onto a social networking platform at Dartmouth College. And she brings to her erudite study of digital culture the literary chops of someone who earned a doctorate in English at Harvard. So please join me in welcoming Virginia Heffernan.
It's true what was said that I take a cultural approach to the Internet, and that has two parts. The first is the magic part where, you know, you've probably heard Bolsheviks for the digital revolution tell you how great it all is and how information wants to be free and how we're going to hack our bodies so that we live forever, that, you know, our mortality are just a few bum lines of code in our meat system and that we're on the brink of eliminating them and we'll live forever. That's the magic part, you know, that half of me believes. And the other half is tugged by a sense of grieving that we've lost something, that we're in the process of losing something that made offline life, life before the Internet, meaningful and valuable. And I'm pleasantly but also entirely surprised that that grieving has taken a positive form that we can see in the return of forms like the three-dimensional book, vinyl records, live music, food culture, maker culture that push back on the digital revolution, that push back on the Internet. The culture's wily that way. And you know, I like to think, you know, when I was in graduate school in English, there were people who believed firmly that either an author or a power structure was responsible for cultural products. And I believe the opposite. I believe that, you know, a collective intelligence or an unconscious can be seen through our cultural products and through our culture. And it's one that, you know, without being completely utopianist, I believe biases the culture toward greater complexity and greater interest and even greater humanity. Those are some of the, that's sort of the structure of the book. Instead of treating either the tubes of the Internet or the code of the Internet, instead of treating the Internet as a business tool or an engineering marvel, I treat it as a cultural phenomenon. And I'll tell you why that is. I have come to believe that the way we came to the Internet, the first time we beheld it, the first glimpse we had of it, determines very much how we see it. So if it was a productivity tool that you were introduced to in the workplace, you tend to see it as a tool that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. If you saw it as a possible way to get rich quick, you wanted to learn how to do search engine optimization. then you see it, you maybe see it as a casino or like a spot to gamble or an obligation. Like, if I'm going to make it in this world, I've got to be on YouTube or I've got to be tweeting more. For whatever reason, I came to it as a child the way a lot of children come to the internet now. I'm 46 years old. But by absolute chance, there's nothing special that I did. I didn't have a like early intuition about the future of the internet. But there, a mainframe computer got set up in my colonial hometown. This was a result of the lucky break that Dartmouth College, which then was mostly known in the late 70s as the football version of the Ivy League, and also the right-wing school in the Ivy League, suddenly got a sheen of intellectual progressiveness since it hired John Kemeny to be the president, who'd been Einstein's assistant at the Advanced Institute of Princeton. John Kemeny was fresh off writing the computer language BASIC. BASIC was known for putting very complicated operations that people were doing in languages, zeros and ones languages like Pascal and Fortran, into natural language. Now, as I believe it to be, and I'm not sure if this is a myth I tell myself, sort of a folktale, but Kameny's coming to the college was such a strange thing for the town that was really focused on liberal arts. Dartmouth has no graduate school. That the town offered him a deal. If he was going to put this hulking mainframe in this kind of hideous-looking building that looked a little—it had tiles that made it look a little like a bathroom— that he would have to be responsible in some ways to the local school children, and he would have to teach them the way that we always imagine the youth are going to be more interested in technology than older people, that he would teach them his computer language BASIC on the grounds that we one day might work for NASA. Now, no one in town had ever worked for NASA. We didn't know anything about it. But the fantasy of parents 10 years after the moon landing was that you might have a child that could, you know, walk on the moon. And the way to do that might have something to do with computers. Anyway, lucky us. We got a lecture on BASIC from the man himself, from the inventor of the language. And he stood up at a chalkboard and wrote a little program that we could do. It was the first time I saw a crossed zero, you know, a zero with a line through it. And it was certainly the first time I saw these, you know, words I kind of knew, like go to, or I could have known as go to. It was one word. And these lines, you know, written in lines, command line code that, you know, had a certain literacy to it and a certain, you know, and I could have been biased as a little child poet, but it looked like a little poem to me. Not only that, but you could make a program, if you put in your brother's name like Andrew, it could end up saying, "You're stupid, Andrew," at the end, which just struck me as like the height of, you know, humor. So I learned how to do that, and I begged my parents not just to get me like some kind of electronic game or Simon or whatever, but to get me a full dumb terminal that would let me, with a coupler, dial in to via a modem to this mainframe, this like heaving rhinoceros computer in the middle of town that suddenly filled my life with like a lot of processing power. Not anywhere near as much as we have in our phones, but a lot more than I could be exposed to without it. So I looked into this deep space computer with phosphor letters. You can picture from War Games. And I couldn't believe it. I was beholding something that on the surface was my own typing in this bright green letters, and behind it, it looked like deep space. And somehow that was available to me. I could like think my way into this space. I didn't think in these terms at the time, but later when I did a PhD in English, I came to understand the difference between literary figures of parataxis and hypotaxis. So I'll start with hypotaxis. Hypotaxis is a way of writing with lots of hierarchies and connections. So if you think of long sentences by Dickens or Jonathan Franzen or Tolstoy that like make it very clear what relation things stand in to each other. And, you know, she thought of putting the glass on the table beside her bed and then knocking over the lamp and so forth. Parataxis are what you see in this is in our box thing, loose connectives. It's like what we loved in the 20th century, Hemingway-style writing, where things only connect with and. You know, he ate a sandwich, and it was good, and so on. Sometimes sentences that don't, that short sentences that almost, you know, you have to make sense of what connects them. Now, Auerbach connected this to the Old Testament. And what he said was that you, in the spaces between the thoughts, you can see the face of God. That was how I felt on the internet, before the internet, in those days when I looked at that screen. There was something coming through and around the letters that I could barely fathom, and I wanted to fathom it. And I wasn't alone. There were all these people dialing into that mainframe who were looking at the same kind of screen I was and trying to figure out who's out there, you know, sounding a signal. And remember, I thought I might work for NASA, so I really thought this was about deep space in some ways, sounding a signal that someone might hear. So the story of the internet is often, almost always, told as a story of some enterprising people in the military, enterprising people in capitalism, building apps to make money or to fight a war. That I want to argue that that's not true, that there's another part of the internet, and it's the part that doesn't speak for itself very much. It's the part that was creating avatars for themselves. They were kids. They were people that felt, in some cases, because the first social network I joined ended up being, and this is significant to talk about today, ended up being a gay cruising site, a closeted site for men looking to meet each other, men and women. I was too young to get a place at the table. I wanted to be able to talk at my father's dinner table and professor's table about literature or about Reaganomics in those days. I had lots of opinions about trickle-down economics, but no one wanted to listen to them because I was 10. So all of a sudden, online, as long as I learned proper capitalization and how to type, I could pass for any age. I could pass for any color. I could pass for a person much more sophisticated and much more sexy than I was. And all these other people were doing the same thing. Now, of course, because I was 9, then 10, 11, 12, I chose the name Athena. I was not going to be Virginia, which was not a great name for a little girl. And I wanted to be powerful. I wanted to live in Second Life. I wanted to be able to talk about these things and like just seem like a warrior, seem like a killer. And the names other people chose were similar. In fact, I got the name because I liked one of the cis frogs, much older than I was, but system programmers, whose name online was Apollo. I thought I might attract him with that, with Athena, but it turned out he was there to meet Ben. Anyway, so we were building. You know how sometimes they say that the bones of men are always near them? There's a bones of a dog? That men and dogs just grew up together, people and dogs grew up together? Well, there's always next to the programming, next to the tubes, next to the code, people making avatars and alter egos to talk about that code and to use those circuits, to use those networks to do the things that humans do, fall in love, tell funny stories, make up names, pretend to be smarter than they are, pretend to be cooler than they are. The internet, I did some reporting in Japan about the internet. The internet is not seen as something that does brain damage to people in Tokyo. The sociologists write about it all the time as the one place that you're free from the name, rank, and serial number world of 3D space. Not all of us kill it in 3D space. You know, some of us don't like sharp elbows and boardrooms, and this is this imaginative space that looks in my mind like that black, dark space. I wasn't happy when the PixMap, or first the bitmap that Apple stole from Xerox, and then the PixMap that we see today on our phones, I wasn't happy to be sealed out that way. I had like all this imaginative room, and all of a sudden, it was user-friendly, which I thought of as like, user obsequious or something. You know, it was like, one thing I say is that it was like I'd had this deep, profound friend that was the mirror of my mind. And all of a sudden, she'd had a bunch of plastic surgery and a makeover, and I could never engage her in, like, beautiful, deep conversation again. That's how I felt when I saw the Mac. And all of a sudden, somebody was much more telling me what to think. So I was looking for a way back in to the internet that I could intuit existed. And eventually I found it. And I even found it on my iPhone. What I couldn't believe was happening all the while that I was thinking about this cultural event, studying English, studying literature, is that I would have conversations with ordinary people about how one woman in Montana told me, you know, I don't use the internet, I don't like television, but I have fibromyalgia, and I went on this message board to find out about my sickness, and I met this woman who's my best friend, and she's coming to visit me from New York tomorrow. And, you know, I thought, why does that have to be an afterthought to her non-experience, her incompetence, she said, on the internet? That seems like the highest use of technology I can imagine. So I loved message boards. I started, you know, during Web 1.0. I, you know, was the first to, I mean, not whatever. I was very quick to go in and look up interests of mine so I could go back to the conference XYZ. That was the early game, and exchange information with people. I should say that early game, conference XYZ, was not just a social network. This is 1979. So the story most people are telling is that there's this weird thing called ARPANET and these EVE networks and ultimately the bulletin boards that are being used, frankly, in this, like, you know, pretty masculinist way where they still have this, you know, unconscious of the military in them and not so unconscious in some cases. But, you know, here we were trying to make this whole new world. And, you know, so the other thing, the hallmark of that early experience was that it was a game. So it was a game with social elements. And in some ways, a game, it had D&D, it had like Dungeons & Dragons details to it. It had masters and slaves, and you could get killed on it. I mean, people sort of dropped that and turned it into a social thing. But, you know, a game that's social, and this, when I was doing the PhD in English, came clear to me, is not a bad description of an art. You know, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, which is a great name for the internet, MMORPG, I don't even try to pronounce it, you know, were the Supreme Court deemed them art, with narrative, and as Scalia said, with narrative and plot lines and characters, and they started as social games. So why did I, for a long period, go off the internet? Well, not only did Conference XYZ fold and the internet kind of go dark because there was no web in the 80s, but there was a day where I was at the computer for so much, so long, and I wanted to try my hand at real social life. So I went out with a group of popular girls, and they said, "You're the one that always spends all her time playing the computer," that's what we called it. And she said, "Desperado." And suddenly I thought, I'm never going on that thing again. and I think that happens also to a lot of us. I mean, now phones are a fashion accessory, but, you know, it's not the way to, like, win friendships to talk a lot about how you're Athena online. So I went off. I came back when the web appeared. I was at Harvard doing English, and I met another person who had a CompuServe address. You may remember mine was 73.773@143@compuserve.com, unforgettable numbers. But he had another one, equally powerfully mnemonic. And he was working at the law school with a group of august law professors talking about how were we going to govern cyberspace. It was like Harvard at the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Like, of course it's going to be us that it falls to make all the laws. And there was a great concern in those days that about child pornography being distributed, because the Bolsheviks for the internet were talking all about free information. And they kept talking about how great it was that information wanted to be free. But the government was terrified about that. They also used to say the First Amendment is just a local ordinance, meaning in China, it's not binding. So, you know, only with that our national boundaries would dissolve into this kind of globalism and we would have to face problems. So because the First Amendment was the obsession of the early information advocates, when the government, when the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, came to speak at Harvard, she talked about the one kind of speech that everyone could agree was terrible, and in that case, it was child pornography. But she also gave some examples of terrible things people had done in the past that the government had been powerless to prosecute. And what she talked about was phone phreaking. It's phreaking. Jobs and Wozniak actually had been phone freaks in their day. They were able, and there's a famous hacker before his time named Joy Bubbles, who is like uniquely able to reproduce the like of, and also the tones of long distance. So he was able to game long distance and get free long distance. So you'd think that that was the scourge of the Assistant Attorney General in 1992. Not at all. The thing she was terrified about was that people were winning radio competitions where you had to be the 10th caller by somehow jamming the line so they came in 10th and they won the $100 or whatever. So just at that point, while I agree child pornography is a problem, I started to worry that our moral system was set up with this hyper-immune system that was simply terrified of this new technology, so terrified that we weren't going to try to even remotely see anything interesting about it. I didn't expect them to read my treatises on Reaganomics, although by the time I was 11, I was really nailing it. I was surprised to hear this panicked dialogue around what might the internet mean. But I was more surprised as the 90s were on into this century that every conversation was, my child is online, they hold their screen too much, or they're looking at their screen. The first thought was, they must be getting fat because they're just sitting at the computers all day, or they're looking at their desktops all day. When it went to mobile, it was, they're not paying attention on the street. I mean, and scientific studies rose to back up with confirmation bias, every intuition we had about attention spans or just something that was making us sick, and started to really use this language. I mean, the brain science of neuroscience grew up practically in response to the internet. And book after book, this is making us shallower, stupider, meaner. You know, the equivalent of people dialing in and getting to be the 10th caller was like, you're 2 minutes into a conversation with someone about the internet, one of the greatest masterpieces of civilization in my view. And they say, there's a lot of bullying on Twitter. That's the first thing. I mean, Twitter's a drop in the bucket with all the things we do online. And yet we're inclined to look for the bad thing. And then we're inclined to commission studies to tell us why it's bad. So I wanted to back up my and other people's, and I would almost say billions of other people's intuition, that there's something exciting artistically going on online. The book is divided into six chapters. There's a memoir chapter, some of which I've given you here. The five chapters treat the building blocks of the internet as not code, not business strategy, not capitalist malevolence, but design, music, text. And one thing I say about text is, you know, they always say we're becoming illiterate. This is the first time in history that our chief intoxicant seems to be texting. We're willing to risk fatal car crashes over and over again to keep reading and writing on our little text boxes. What's so exciting about making and consuming words except the same thing that has been so exciting about consuming and reading words since the dawn of civilization, since the beginning of literacy? So this seems clearly to me like an extension of civilization. I then go on to treat film and photography. I mean, it's very drawing the line between 35mm photography, darkroom photography, Flickr, Instagram, and now Snapchat also. It was a great privilege. You know, it's like the dream of every cultural critic to come to, it's like feels like unearthing a new civilization and being the only one who cares to talk about it, although so many people care to talk about it. I mean, it's been at talks like these that I've heard about like each new development. One thing we used to say about YouTube, videos would live forever. Great thing about the internet is, the strange or great or fascinating thing about the internet, everything lives forever. All of a sudden, Snapchat. You know what I want? A video that doesn't live forever. So every time we get comfortable in some assessment of the internet, the culture produces something new to challenge it. I am not at all immune to the losses. One of the things I talk about in the book, and the word loss comes from this, and then I'll open to questions or interview. The word loss comes from engineering. So compression of a digital sound that loses something, like MP3 compression, is called lossy compression. That loss is something I remember, and maybe you do think of this too, with the iPod and then the iPhone. Just something was not quite right when I started to take all my music, you know, to my little device. You know, we have much better sound with Tidal, and I think Spotify is a bigger signal too, but what was that thing? Was it just some kind of emotional connection? Was I, like, tricking myself, like the people who think everything new is bad? I don't know. But I tried very hard in the book to make sense of that, both through a certain amount of music theory and through engineering. And that's what I do in each chapter. So that is the book, Magic and Loss. I feel that I've focused more on the magic than the loss, and that's probably not an accident. But I promise I don't just cheerlead for every new thing that comes along. And I'd love to hear some questions. Yeah, you get special privilege.
Can you talk a little more about why you did title the book Magic and Loss? Because you look at that and you don't immediately know, unless you read the subtitle, that it is a book about the internet.
Yeah, Magic and Loss, the internet as art. The subtitle used to be The Pleasures of the Internet, because for whatever reason, I thought that some French theorists in the last century, including Roland Barthes, who had a book called The Pleasures of the Text, was very much in sync with the way we use the internet now. Bart loves to, he didn't believe in linear reading. He loves to skip around in the book, and some of that skipping around, leaving things unread, choosing to read, he didn't see those as moral failings. He saw them as like great playful pleasures. So The Pleasures of the Internet was the subtitle. And magic and loss, magic is an Apple word, so magic really seemed like, and it's also a word coders use to describe, Arthur C. Clarke says that any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. So there's something about the like, oh, it's magic when you open an app, you know, that feeling like we're in exciting new territory. So that was the magic. The loss came straight from lossy compression. I was kind of enchanted by that word. Engineers, like, lossy. It's, like, just not a word in the language, but it is now. And it seemed like such an emotional word. You know, there's a lot of writing, engineers writing, just describing their work. And that was what Conference XYZ was, too. Sysprogs just kind of trying to make sense of what they were doing, where they stumble into something emotional. But bridging that gap between the right brain and the left brain, you know, was sort of something I wanted to do with loss. The internet is art. Well, too many people told me The Pleasures of the Internet would just sounded like pornography. so I had to abandon it in favor of something more dignified sounding.
And we were talking earlier about how you were able to find a publisher for this book, given that, as you mentioned in your talk, you were proposing a point of view that was, you know, at best in a minority. And really went against the views of millions of others about the internet. So how was it that you were describe that process a little?
Well, it's funny. So when you sell a book, you sell it on a proposal. And my proposal for the book was a lot more timid than the book ended up, because I was just a lot less confident of the thesis. And frankly, I just wanted it to fit in a little more with the category of writing about the internet. And not many people identified themselves as reporters on digital culture in those days. There wasn't even a phrase digital culture. So I went around to publishers that were interested but skeptical and were ready to make an offer on the book. And I was sitting in it with a group of people and they said, you know, we like the idea that you're writing about the internet, but is there any way you could put the word science in the subtitle? And I was like, I have great respect for scientists. The only problem is I don't know anything about science. You know, I happen to know about Chaucer, but I don't know anything about, like, the biology of nerves or how the brain works. And reading up very quickly on neuroscience and telling some just-so stories about neuroscience just doesn't seem to be, like, where I'm headed. And, you know, one thing I came to realize when I was pitching stories to the Times was the technology is a perfectly suitable masculine form of the word culture. And sometimes I would say, I want to do a story about culture, this cultural phenomenon of, well, in one case, it was Finspiration, this particular kind of video made by anorexics to inspire anorexics. That's also been banned speech in some places. So I said, I want to write about the culture of this Finspiration. Not really interested. I'd like to write about the technology of Finspiration. You know what? That sounds like a great story. And technology, techne, and culture are not fundamentally that different. They're built objects that thrive on elegance. And so I forgave myself for smuggling in culture stories under the name of technology. A lot of other people now write about, there's departments in digital humanities, digital culture. You know, now it probably wouldn't be so tough a sell. But in those days, I. And by the way, I was not confident. I was like, yeah, maybe I'll try to learn a lot of science and rewrite the prospectus, but fortunately I didn't.
And in coming up with this new structure, this new aesthetic to approach the internet, why pick these five or six categories that you did?
Well, you know, literary history is pretty well-trodden story, literary history, mostly in the West. You know, the building blocks, like maybe in Aristotle's time, included dance and included theater. But roughly, I decided that dance and theater were sort of part of video. A lot of the ascendant videos, you know, the top videos, show dance, show forms of theater. And film, you know, things that didn't exist in Aristotle's day. And otherwise, music, poetry or text, and still images, painting, frescoes, and then film seemed to cover, like, in the history of the arts, exactly what to me signals that something's a civilization or an art form.
So look ahead. Where do you see the internet going and our lives going with it?
Well, one thing I see is, and I know I'm giving away my background in, maybe Hegel, but I see a pushback on digital culture. So, you know, foodism, for instance, the rise of foodism, you know, obsession with food. You see it all the time on television and pictures people take and hair splitting around what coffee tastes like what, seems to me a response to the rise of the web. You know, you can't digitize food and you can't digitize human contact so far. The real evangelists for the web are obsessed with immortality, but, you know, there's something wonderful about things that decay, the things that die, the things that don't live forever. And, you know, the culture is always torn between these two things. It's like art, you know, art long, life short. And you know, all the wonderful things that people say about why it makes sense that we have these, like, fathom-long bodies and we live these, you know, lives of 70 or 80 years, if we're lucky, you know, that's existence. And I'm not surprised that the secular mindfulness movement, which is, you know, about inhabiting the body, has risen during exactly this time where we've been living in this abstraction forever. I mean, I think about, like, in the School of Athens, you know, Plato points up, the truth is up here in the cloud. You know, I really do think that the cloud is like this kind of heavenly vision. And Aristotle points down, the truth is right here, right under our feet, right in the earth. So what I expect next is lots of anti-digital culture. And the success of this bookstore, you know, the recent success of this bookstore is selling human contact, selling contact with objects, with the feeling of paper, with texture, with smells, with undigitizable aesthetic experiences, I think, you know, bears witness to this.
Well, the other question that I had is, do you see something ironic in you releasing this very thoughtful work about the internet, about in digital culture, not on the internet, but yeah, in the physical book form?
Well, you know, it's a hybrid. I mean, the book as a manuscript lived entirely online. I never printed it out even to, like, get the order. I know some writers do. Lived in the cloud. It lived on Google Drive for most of its life. And the day that it was released, you know, the place that I looked for it was Amazon, digitally, you know, the surface of the bookstore, the window of the bookstore, and the reviews and the social life was all around Amazon, and that was digital. And it also was released in three forms on one day. It was in digitally compressed sound as an audiobook. It was in an ebook, and then it was also in this book. And a lot of the advanced copies were in Kindle form or were in digital form. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, one part of this resistance to digital culture that I was describing is that we love to all be together, but we also love to take Instagram pictures of that and circulate it to everyone to show that you've been at the beach, to, or, you know, that you had your hair a certain way or whatever. So I think this hybrid is certainly where we are now. There may be a more radical pushback. You know, you see it a little bit with, like, millennials switching to flip phones, less capability, tech Sabbaths, you know, where people swear off the internet for days on end. Oh, a millennial, or I shouldn't say that, a young person, younger than I am person, in San Francisco recently experimented. He wanted to break his addiction to Facebook. And this isn't in the book at all, but he put a little bit of LSD subcutaneously in his body for breakfast. It was, like, called LSD breakfast. And he found, I'm not advocating this, but he found that he suddenly lost interest in his boring phone with the, like, Apple, because the faces of people on the bus were mesmerizing. And that's where I think we are going. We can do that without the LSD. It's the best interface out there, looking at a face, looking at a tree. I mean, for heck's sake, I look at my phone all the time, but, like, it's this big and it has, like, apps. It's the most boring thing, and you've seen it so many times, you know? So I think that's, you know, I think, I hope we'll learn to do that without the drugs.
So I want to say thank you for changing my view of the internet in a lot of ways, because I realized that I, being one of those millennial, came in kind of in that second wave when it was already reaching the computer form, and, you know, it was already being mass marketed to you. But, you know, in my mind, you know, you feel like, oh, that's when the internet started, was when you had the, you know, completed operating systems and you could watch DVDs on it and everything like that.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by this idea of being at the beginning of this era, and that, you know, we've gone so far into it that we're having those backlashes and these reactions.
Yeah.
So I was reading C by Tom McCarthy.
Yeah.
And that, like, the way you talk about the internet, it feels the same way that he has these two young savants talking about the, you know, beginning of the radio age and biology. And I wonder if it is something to do with that being on that front end of innovation with the open boundaries, that can kind of change the way you view any of our current systems.
Yeah.
So, you know, with your literature background, I'm sure the been documenting different, you know, periods and histories and eras and, you know, being in the internet era. So I'm just curious what you think about, since you share that kind of magic with McCarthy and his Necronautical Society and all that other stuff, what you think about being the impact it has of being in there, being there at Dartmouth College when there was a mainframe, being an early adopter.
I mean, while I am old, and that was, you know, that was 30, 35 years ago, 36 years ago. We're still in the very early stages of all these online forms. You know, the history of film, I had a professor at Harvard who said, you know, maybe we haven't even seen a great movie yet. You know, it took a long time for the novel to find itself. You know, it was, you know, about 200 years or so, sorry, it was about 150 years before you saw, you know, George Eliot or certainly Hemingway. And so I still caution against saying that, you know, we are already producing the best, the best the internet is capable of. Like, we're sort of in, like, you know, birth of a nation phase. So it's, like, really interesting to look back on, you know, will be really interesting to look back on, but we may not be there yet. And I also think that the systems themselves are so far the masterpieces. So, you know, we're not going to find a photograph that's like Henri Cartier-Bresson because the social structure doesn't look to people and great authors that way and also is inclined to look with disdain on these products. But look what happened with television. So television was, it's really hard to explain what an evil it was considered, what a public health hazard, how horrible it was. I will say that when mothers first saw it, that there was a way to keep their kids out of trouble and keep them from fighting with each other and keep them from breaking their legs and, you know, not have to hire a babysitter, get a little housework done while they watched Howdy Doody, they thought it was a miracle. They thought you could get a kid to sit still without handcuffs, you know? And all they were looking at was a bunch of clowns on TV. Like, it just didn't instantly read as, like, you know, strychnine poisoning, you know, just to the system. But, you know, sooner or later it came to be regarded that way and blamed for, you know, everything. Blamed for the obesity epidemic, blamed for short attention spans, blamed for promiscuity. The same thing happened with the novel. Like, you know, always get your head out of the book. And there's a great essay, The Causes of Female Depravity in Novel Readers, that young women who read novels in the 19th century and they were the chief consumers of novels. And incidentally, a lot of these forms skew feminine, including Instagram and so forth. It was like they were going to become lascivious adulteresses if they read these books. And it said it's instilling poison into the bloodstreams of women. I mean, it sounds so close to the way we actually describe brain damage in people who, you know, use the internet a lot. So that's another sign that it's a new form, that we're very scared of it. We're very scared of it. You know, one other thing I think about is in Switzerland, the early chalets that were built at the foot of the Alps or somewhere in the Alps had no windows on the side that faced the Alps because they were too scary. Everyone wanted to look on a little garden. And, you know, right now we have a sublime phenomenon on the internet. It's almost embarrassing to talk about it. It's like, I'm now going to tell you about love. You know, it's like the air we breathe or evil. You know, I think if we could make one window toward the, like, some people call it the postmodern sublime, this thing that we're all making so fast. I mean, it's billions of us. The number of cell phones that exist in the world almost is close to the world's population. Like, getting a hold on that, of course it makes us worried and anxious.
Your subtitle got me thinking, even though it is a polite alternative to something that was more suggestive at first, but
The pleasures. The pleasures of the internet.
Yeah.
It's for pleasure. There should be a better word.
Yeah. But I was thinking about art in the internet.
Yeah.
And kind of community art. I got to memes eventually. Do you write about memes?
Oh, yeah.
At all? Do you have any thoughts?
I think I sort of, my fascination with GIFs, memes, emoji came later in the writing of the book, and I haven't like mustered enough courage to do like a close reading of the general phenomenon of memes, but you know, I not to like keep claiming credit in the humanities, but the humanities had really my mentor at UVA, Richard Rorty, was very interested in how natural selection, I mean, the reason that memes sounds like genes is like how do a culture's, that's a terrible word, like elemental components survive? Like a bicycle, like a Schwinn. Like when does it? When it, what does it look like in Africa when like the meme of the bicycle, which carries with it all this stuff about how people move? When I remember him saying, like, you see that in sub-Saharan Africa, does that ruin the landscape? Or is that, like, an adaptation, you know, that has triumphed for one reason or another? So it's funny that it's come to, like, describe these things that we think of as humor, but partly that's, like, a nervousness around how cool they are, you know? Like, I just can't... the amount of communication, and I'm not, like, super gifted. Like, I think that the GIF, at least... skills is a velocity one. You know, like, I don't understand. I don't know if you get that. I don't understand how on Slack or on texting someone just has, like, the perfect GIF at their fingertips for something. You just, like, can't believe how they do it. I mean, that skill is, like, you know, photography or poetry. Like, I don't know how it happens. What do they have? Like, an encyclopedic knowledge of Giphy? And I didn't even know that Giphy was the secret for a long time, too. So I was like, what? Are you just go on the internet and dig this up? But anyway, so I... And, you know, those are a nice encapsulation of a lot of memes. And if you're thinking about, like, lolcats or the PWNED, like, you know... 1337 leet language or whatever. That is, you know, it's scary. It's like writing about punk rock sometimes. You know, I used to be like, oh no, I have to review a punk documentary. I'm going to get it wrong because, you know, the crowd really loves to jump on mistakes. One time, for example, I wrote in the Times, I was talking about typos and how important they are online. And I said, you know, you make a typo like T-E-H for the, and I got so much mail saying you're laughing because you're like, do you know this? The T-E-H is not just a typo. It's like a thing that means a thousand things. Like it just means like stupid. It means like internets or whatever. And I just, it's like this crazy code. And I've had that actually, like, just to be more confessional, I've had that same thing happen with, I stumbled into like a race meme without meaning to. I mean, Tez, funny, but you know, you stumble around with this language. It's like all these frequencies that people are hearing it on, and you can, you know, make really big mistakes. But one thing as a writer that's done is put a lot of pressure. It's like being exposed to like tons of microflora and microbes and, you know, that test your immune system. And your prose gets better. I mean, you know, I hate it when people complain, like, people get offended so easily when I just say this simple thing, like, Hillary is shrill or whatever. You know, not knowing that that, like, falls into a whole history of shrill. Well, learn that it does, you know? You used to have to learn, like, history and literature and you know, you had to fact check stuff. It was up to me to learn T-E-H was, you know, belonged to someone else's idiom. And if I was going to use it, I had to use it responsibly. I mean, you know, that's what learning to write is. And the internet has been, I mean, reading a ton on the internet, living on message boards, has been how I, you know, tested my immune system.
Thank you for all these great thoughts. I also wanted to ask you about using the term art for the internet.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned it as sort of like the role-playing game definition where it's participatory, and maybe it's just because I've been visiting DC for the summer and going to all the museums that the first thing when I thought of art was not participatory. It was, you know, the painting of the nobility and... your comments made me think about the ways that, you know, at sometimes art has been, you know, cave paintings, and at others it's very exclusive. And so then when you say, you know, Apple's shutting us out with its interface, this tension between, you know, involvement or lack thereof is like, you know, how much are we sort of like in our networks that, you know, that's the dominant metaphor for the internet now, and just your thoughts on that tension.
I love this question because one of the other things said about television in its low times was that kids didn't do anything. Like they were just like spellbound and in a stupor before it, and they were having their minds programmed by television. That was a like huge concern for a long time. And now you say, like, they're just manically tweeting all the time and they can't stop going on Instagram. I mean, which is it? Like, we don't want them to be, you know, participating, or we, you know, we do. And, you know, one of the claims for, you know, by the creators of YouTube, for example, Steve Chen and Chad Hurley, was like, finally, we're going to be sharing videos. It's not just like, thank you for coming, by the way. We're going to be sharing video. It's not going to be like movie theaters just telling us what to think. At the same time, I mean, not to just take a complete cliche, but just to simplify the story, the social world makes meaning of art, and it makes clear how you, what you genuflect before, and how, what your proper relation to a work of art is. First in the art market, because, you know, people talk things up and it becomes the right time for something, and, you know, suddenly this thing is important. But, you know, the Mona Lisa used to hang in the Salle du Carré, I think, you know, in a very different place. Certainly wasn't the focal point of the Louvre. And then for a million social reasons, it became, you know, the thing people wanted to see. So in that way, that's the social part. The game part is a little trickier, but it actually, the idea that art is a game grows out of a lecture I heard on Hamlet, which is, you remember, like, Hamlet at one point has been watching that play within a play, and he says, like, this is so terrible. I think it's like, I can't remember which soliloquy it is, but like, it's like, this actor, like, in a dream of sorrow, moves himself to tears. Like, this is terrible. Like, all he's doing is inventing something, and he's crying. And the worry was that art is deception, that something else is going on. There's a beautiful review of this book and my friend Tom Vanderbilt's great book called You May Also Like, today in The New Yorker. And, you know, it was a great review, but it also had a little of this in it, which is that his idea was, like, Google's controlling us with all its many, all its many services and algorithms, or Facebook is with Instagram, that there's nothing to the essays that you see posted on Facebook. It's all being determined by this algorithm. That was Hamlet's fear, you know, that you shouldn't have this experience, is like, there's something deceitful, there's masquerade. You know, that's yet another understandable but fear about art. And my, you know, response to that is, we know, like, you're not pretending to be someone different when you're playing a game, for example, even if it's a fantasy game like Dungeons and Dragons. I knew I wasn't a cleric. There was great fear, or a dwarf, or whatever. There was great fear that we would, like, there was a book about it, that we would, like, all dissolve into the game and have some LSD illusions that we were high priestesses or whatever. That sounds to me like the fear of the internet. But I didn't have really that trouble, any more than I thought that I was the shoe when I was playing Monopoly. Like, you know what I mean? And so I like the idea, you know, you've been in museums. I like the idea that we have these, like, roles, you know, while we behold art. Looking at art in a museum is especially self-conscious, you know? It's like, you want to have the proper reaction to things. You want to pay attention. There's an actual phenomenon called museum fatigue, and I think partly it's like playing that role for a long time and being seen watching art is exhausting. It's kind of exhausting. So that's the game. And, you know, I wasn't an early adopter of massively games like World of Warcraft, but it's astounding how much Bitcoin, which might be the, you know, the future of currency, grows out of, in some ways, you know, gold mining on World of Warcraft, which, you know, people 10 years ago used to, like, pay people to mine gold for them on Minecraft. I mean, on, oh my God, it's slipping, World of Warcraft. You know, when my daughter is playing the character Steve on Minecraft, she does not walk away from the game and say, like, now I'm Steve and I can make things. It's just, you know, but, and Minecraft, I mean, Clive Thompson wrote a great piece about it, is an extraordinary, extraordinary phenomenon. And by the way, just like the internet, when I was looking at it on that dark screen and my mother would be like, what are you doing? and I would be like, I'm Athena. You know, she would look at it and not know. It's just totally opaque to me when I look at Minecraft. You know, my daughter's like, I'm going to explain my world. And it's like so monochrome, you know, and she's just like, don't you see the swimming pool? Just like you were just like describing a dream to me. I can't tell one thing from the other in Minecraft. That's exactly how it should be. I mean, punk, that's not music. You know, texting, that's not reading. Playing Minecraft, that's not making anything. You know, it should be invisible. It should be barely legible to people older than you, or it's not art. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.